Welcome to the 238th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. I hope all of you had a healthy and merry Christmas. We did here at the Delaney slash Minerich household. Addie and Nathan came in to visit, and we had our traditional Christmas Eve party this year, so it was a lot of fun. A lot of people, and even my mother, when we first went plant-based, was worried that nobody would ever want to come to our house again because we would do this Christmas Eve party, and when we went plant-based, she didn't think anybody else would ever want to come. But nevertheless, the party has gone on many years, and we have great fun in preparing it. We spend all day Christmas Eve and the day before making things, and love to share it with our friends and family. In fact, we had a new neighbor in the area come and visit this year, and they thought they were mainly plant-based, but they were actually surprised that you could do a whole table plant-based. We had veggie trays. Addie made one like a wreath, and she made one like a snowman. We did a spinach dip to go with that, which was a raw spinach dip that had water chestnuts, and various vegetables, and we did a crabless stuffing for mushrooms. We had little carrot dogs, so I made the pizza dough recipe that's in our cookbook and made little wraps for mini carrots that had been marinated. We did the omega balls, which are our meatless balls out of the cookbook. We did a cranberry salad. My mother made it her Italian marinated green beans with roasted red peppers. We had our famous stuffed shells, and so my mother and I compete. We do our own little different versions of spices in the stuffed shells that have that use silken tofu as a base, and our stuff with spinach, a little garlic in those, and a secret ingredient that's in the cookbook. And then we did a relish tray that had some roasted peppers and beets. So it was, and we had vegan sushi. I didn't make the vegan sushi. Our local grocer made brown rice vegan sushi for us. So it was a really nice spread, and everybody was able to enjoy themselves but not be miserable afterwards from eating all the high grease, high salt food. So I think, and then we did desserts. It is the holidays, so this is our time to splurge a little bit. I found a recipe online for a quinoa brittle that I did that had quinoa and chia seeds and oats, which turned out really good. We did an oatmeal cookie that we had substituted dried tropical fruits, since we're down here in Florida, instead of raisins. So that was fun and made that colorful. And then we did a chocolate mint cookie, so with a little bit of the candy cane dressing on the outside. So it was nice. Wasn't overdone. And Addie made a gingerbread cake. We decorated that with a little tree on top. So we had a lot of fun. There's always a lot of fruit around at our household. We do Harry and David pears usually to celebrate the season, but I'm a huge fan, as most of you know, of persimmons, so those are in season. So I was able to, actually, our local grocery store produce guy, if you ever go to a produce section and you're looking for something, they don't have it. Often if you just ask the produce manager, he can get things in. So he has been able to get me in Fuji persimmons all season long, so that was great. Apples, oranges. Pineapple, a friend of mine made us an outfit for our pineapple that we use for Thanksgiving. It's a turkey, it's a crocheted or sewn turkey head that you put on top of a pineapple, and you use the pineapple greenery for the turkey tail. So the pineapple, or so our pineapple Santa was on the table, and he can be used later on for breakfast without any pain involved. So that's always pretty cool. One of the things that I said on the last podcast, and we were able to continue through the holiday season, is that we didn't get off our exercise circuits. I'm training for the Houston Half Marathon and the Austin Full Marathon, and Addie's training for the Houston Half Marathon as well. Nathan is doing a December called Deadcember deadlift challenge. Nathan is the strength coach for the Houston football team, University of Houston football team. So he is our weightlifter of the family, if you're new to the pod listed, power lifter, I should say. So he is doing a challenge for December where he deadlifts every day. So he went to our local gym and did a three-day membership so that he could deadlift and do his workout for the day. And Addie and I did our runs, and Nathan joined us on the runs a couple of days. Michael was also joined us on the run. So we got our exercise in, and we did not count going shopping as exercise, but we did our regular exercise. I am still doing, since August, my daily planks, and I've been finding that extremely helpful, so I continue to do my planks each morning. So it was great. Addie and Nathan brought their cat and dog, a cat named Buckwheat after the flower, and Haas, their German Shepherd puppy. He's all 80 pounds of the puppy, so he really needed his run every day. And so the three rescues got along great, and everybody had a great time. And the dogs ate vegan, the cats ate their food, and everybody was happy. Every morning we started out with oatmeal and a big bowl of fruit. We had a couple stir fries for dinner, more along the line of Thai stir fries with vegetables that we get. Again, I've been getting and been very happy with the Misfits boxes that I order online. And they come on Friday, and so I just use the vegetables that are in the boxes and supplement with some other vegetables. And that's worked out very, very well. One morning, or actually Christmas morning, we made a tofu scramble. We had some salt rice and bread that I've made. I make those loaves ahead of time and freeze them, so we brought those out and used them. We made some soups. We had a pho soup. I have lemongrass growing in the backyard. We have oregano in the backyard. Basil. So we have all kinds of herbs that we can, you know, go out and pick fresh, which is a lot of fun. So good food had by all. We cooked in the whole time. Addie was and Nathan were here. Enjoyed every meal together. So it was great. So since it is the end of the year, I thought I would share with you a few of the studies that were published over the last year that had some nutritional bearing that kind of shook the regular general medical community. Maybe surprising to some. I was glad to see it. Obviously, it makes our life a lot easier the more physicians that get on board with plant-based nutrition and start to realize that what you eat makes a huge difference in your health and your longevity. It's not about eat what you want and we'll fix you later, but it's about eat to stay healthy. So one of the studies that I'd like to start out with was a JAMA study that looked at lifestyle and the genetic risk and how lifestyle and genetics are intertwined with the incidence of dementia. A lot of people aren't afraid to get coronary artery disease because they can get a stent or bypass, and you know, people even think that cancers are treatable, and diabetes is treatable, high blood pressure is treatable, but we all realize that once you get dementia, there's really no turning back. It's a progressive disease that robs people of their memories. It can be a very slow and progressive disease that is really hard for the people that have to watch a loved one suffer. And, you know, people that have had someone with dementia in their family usually fear that more than any of the other lifestyle diseases. So, people wonder if there's, you know, a genetic aspect. And, of course, if you have two of the APOE genes, you have 9 times the risk of Alzheimer's or dementia than the general population. But that doesn't mean you're doomed to have dementia or, you know, that's going to be what actually gets you. And we know from some studies that, you know, eating a high-fiber, high plant-based diet can, you know, in countries where they do that, even if they have, two of the genes, the incidence of dementia is very low. But this was a retrospective cohort study, so they look back in time. It was done on a European ancestry trial, and they looked at 60-year-old people that did not have dementia at the time, and then there were 196,383 of them, and they looked at people that had genetic risk factors for Alzheimer's and lived an unfavorable lifestyle, or they looked at people that lived a favorable lifestyle and genetic risk. And what they found was that, and I guess we should go a little bit into a favorable and unfavorable lifestyle. And so a favorable lifestyle meant that people didn't smoke, that they exercised typically 3 to 5 times a week with some vigorous exercise. They ate 4 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. They actually included moderate alcohol because they felt that alcohol intake and the risk of dementia followed more of a U-shaped curve, meaning that a moderate intake of alcohol, there may be a slight decrease in dementia, but certainly if you get beyond a point, then that's going to also, you know, obviously increase your risk of dementia. So they included those things into the favorable lifestyle category. And what they noted was that despite having a high genetic risk for Alzheimer's, if you lived a favorable lifestyle, you had a much more favorable outcome. And so if you looked at hazards ratio, an unfavorable lifestyle and a high genetic risk was worse with a 2.83 hazardous risk, meaning it was just a statistically significant worse risk of getting dementia if you had the gene and lived an unfavorable lifestyle. But if you had the genetics for dementia and lived a favorable lifestyle, you had a very low risk of dementia. So again, or a significantly less likely chance of getting dementia. So no matter what your genes are, living a favorable lifestyle will decrease your risk of dementia regardless if you have the genetics for early Alzheimer's or not. So that is very good for everybody out there. So instead of running out and getting your test for whether you're going to get Alzheimer's or not, and then sitting in either and worrying because you have the gene or living frivolously if you don't have the gene, we know now that you're better off living a healthy lifestyle. And, you know, I would probably take it one step further that when you're eating a diet rich in plants and fruits and vegetables and high fiber, and you completely eliminate animal products, you're going to even help yourself more. But that is my inference from the study. Another study that was looked at is high fructose corn syrup and colon cancer risk. So high fructose corn syrup from corn, which is in just about all processed foods, anything in a box, pasteurized foods, anything that you buy with breading on it, any breading. So if you get a French fry at McDonald's, it was already breaded and fried at the factory, then it's refried, you know, at the store locally. And that's typically, you know, if you go to any kind of a chain restaurant and have something fried, whether it's fried mushrooms, those things are already breaded and then fried and then refried. At the, you know, the location. So you're getting a double dose of oil along with this high fructose corn syrup that's in the breading. Of course, pastries, all the sports drinks and energy drinks, high fructose corn syrup, a lot of the juices that children are exposed to, high fructose corn syrup, take it on down to ketchups and sauces, high fructose corn syrup. So it's really, really everywhere to the point where it's been projected that by the year 2030, that there'll be a 90 to 125% increase in colon cancer in 20 to 30-year-olds and a 20 to 40% increase in 35 to 49-year-olds. So that's crazy. And of course, one of the researchers suggested, you know, we're starting to do screening earlier, but, we don't want to just screen. We have to turn this around. And the mechanism postulated, glucose is taken up, regular old glucose, is taken up by pathways that involve a sodium-potassium pump. But fructose corn syrup is a more passive uptake via trans porter called GLUT5. And it can be overwhelmed with the amount of high fructose corn syrup that's in the traditional American diet. So as little as 5 grams of the stuff can overwhelm this transporter. And so now the colon is seeing a lot more high fructose corn syrup than it should because the body can't take it up and process it. So it's leading to increased cancer cells in the colon. And they looked at mice studies and selecting for mice that were at risk for polyps, and just giving them one soda a day increased the change in polyps to more of a dysplastic or a precancerous polyps. So it doesn't take a whole lot of this stuff to really cause a problem. And it turns out that colon cancers are also very good uptake. They can uptake this fructose very easily. Fructose is also converted into fat and leads to fatty acid generation. And these fatty acids are used to grow by the tumors to grow as well. So, when people talk about sugar being, a problem with cancer, it's this high fructose corn syrup is much, much worse because it hits cancer cells two different ways, not only by a sugar pathway, but also by a fatty acid pathway. And it almost, and there's some indication that it rewires, these metabolic pathways to actually favor the synthesis of fatty acids. Of course, there's increased risk of fatty liver with this high uptake fructose corn syrup. There's also a stimulation or upregulation of inflammasomes, and that has been associated with inflammation that even can cause increasing cardiovascular disease and plaque rupture and atherosclerosis. But it also leads to more inflammatory bowel disease, and we know that people that have inflammatory bowel disease also have a risk of cancer. So, take note of things that you're purchasing and look and see, is there high fructose corn syrup in that? And that should be, not only looking at sodium content in box foods, but if you start looking at box foods for sodium content and high fructose corn syrup and oils, you'll pretty quickly realize that anything in a box is really bad news, because you're going to see sunflower oil and palm oil and olive oil, and then you're going to see high fructose corn syrup. And, in addition to some of these other chemicals, you start looking, and of course the sodium content of things as a preservative, it's also leading to big problems. And that leads into a study published in the British Medical Journal about salt. We know the American Heart Association recommends less than 1,500 milligrams of sodium a day. But, the standard American diet, and according to this study, the British diet, the average intake of salt can be up to 10 grams a day in men and 8 grams in women. And so when they looked at, the association with gastric cancers, the UK decided to, at one point, decrease the salt, the regulations to decrease the salt in processed foods. And so in the year 2003, they started to decrease, there was a regulation to decrease the salt in this processed food, hoping to decrease the risk of gastric cancer. And they postulated that it was, linked to increased risk of cardiovascular disease, about 9,900 cases a year, and about increased risk of gastric cancer at about 1,500 cases a year. So they went back and they looked at the population since the change, and there was actually a deregulation called the responsibility deal that occurred in 2011 that actually lessened the restrictions on sodium in processed food, lessened the penalty and for the salt. So they were able to look back and see the sodium intake of individuals, how it started to go down, and then now how it started to actually become more lax. And they did this by looking at 24-hour urines in their population, because that's the most accurate. People will say, oh, I don't hardly eat any salt. But you start thinking about it, where is salt located? It's even in, baked goods, baking soda has salt, tamari, again, any of the sauces, canned foods, cured meats, just about anything that's packaged, chips, cereals, even milk, you know, mustards, depending on what kind of mustard you get, you know, all kinds of things have, you know, a tremendous amount of salt in it. And stomach cancer is the fourth leading cause of cancer death. So when they went back and they looked, in 2000 to 2001, the average salt intake was 10.5 grams for men and 8 grams for women. 2003 to 2010, there was a 0.2 decrease in salt intake in men and 0.12 percentage decrease in women. And then after this responsibility deal was passed, now that, you know, it's lessened, it's only 0.1 gram difference, 0.07 gram difference in females. So, you know, again, the salt is starting to creep back into the British diet, and they estimate that it's, you know, it could cost 160 million euros as far as healthcare cost in this population. Not to mention 26,000, you know, additional cardiovascular deaths and about 3,800 gastric cancers. If you look at, you know, they projected from 2019 to 2025. So, you know, we look at salt as people saying, well, I don't have high blood pressure, I don't have to worry so much about salt. But salt is a direct toxin to the blood vessel. And that's why when people get older, they start to get stiff blood vessels. The systolic blood pressure becomes very high, and the diastolic pressure will actually drop, because if you think about it, it, you know, becomes like a stiff pipe that the blood vessel itself can't absorb the shock of the blood coming through it. So people start to get high blood pressure as they age, and that's just from chronic damage over the years. But it doesn't take, you know, this, the salt starts to also have the effect with increased volume retention and starts to be hard on the kidneys. So just saying that, you know, you're young and you don't have a problem yet is certainly, you know, not accurate. And the risk of, you know, gastric cancer is very, very serious with, you know, not a really good prognosis that requires a major abdominal surgery. And if you start again and look at fast foods that our young people are exposing themselves to, and people that eat out multiple times a week at these restaurants getting this high salt diet, you can see why, you know, this is just going to become a huge problem, you know, for younger and younger individuals. And it's very sad. You know, I still look back at, you know, the race. Again, I'm going to say, you know, we were in Sacramento looking at the 5K and look at these people trying to run and people trying to exercise off a bad diet. And you can't do it calorically because of all the density of the food, the high fat in the food, the high fructose corn syrup. But you also can't run off the salt in this food. So, you know, there's just so much damage, and people get a taste for the salt. You know, they start to want to taste that first. I've had people in class say something's missing. It's like, yeah, it's that salty flavor. And, you know, even athletes will say, well, you know, I need more sodium to retain more water. And that's been shown to not be, you know, you can't eat more salt, retain more water, and then have to drink less during a marathon. It doesn't work. You're just going to be carrying more weight. And if, you know, if you want to drive the point home, you know, for every pound that you lose, you gain 2 minutes on a marathon, you know, so, or, I'm sorry, if you lose a pound, you're going to, you know, you're going to decrease your time by, you know, a couple of minutes, which can be, you know, the equivalent of a $140 pair of sneakers that have, you know, the carbon plate in them. So just lighting, you know, weighing less going into a race is going to help you. So you certainly don't want a fluid salt load, so you're carrying more fluid. That doesn't work. And, you know, of course, the salty drinks are made so that you're thirsty and you drink more and you don't become dehydrated. But again, dehydration is never an issue. You have to be very, very dehydrated before it affects your performance or health. On the other hand, taking in excessive amounts of sodium and having excessive amounts of water diluting your blood is much, much more dangerous. So start watching, you know, the sodium and the things, and, you know, take a little mental note of everything that you eat that has salt in it. You'll be terribly surprised and horrified, you know, how much salt that you can get in a day. I refuse to buy tomatoes that have any salt added, you know, so low salt doesn't cut it. Forget about low salt. It just costs more money, and it's not, you know, they're cutting the sodium by 10 or 15%. Go no added salt. And, you know, there's several companies are making those kind of tomato products now because you can really cut down your sodium when you do that, when you're thinking about tomato sauces. Cutting out processed, you know, foods and chips, that's going to cut down your sodium. Look at the, you know, your condiments for the sodium content to cut that down. Certainly, you know, don't add salt to your food, but really, really watch how much sodium is in things. Even things like miso can really vary how much sodium is in it. You're also looking at things that are, besides, you know, baking soda and tamari and sauces, but cured meats, even pickled things tend to be pickled or preserved with salt. So there can be a wide range of sodium in those things. So you really have to watch. You can rinse some of it off, but you're not going to get it all off. There's probably some, you know, how does salt cause gastric cancer? There's probably some associated with H. pylori. Seems to be that the salt really will enhance the damage that H. pylori can do. The mechanism is being worked out, but, you know, one would postulate that there's a change in gut microbe. There's also a change in the cell structure and the decreased mucus around the cells with an increased salt intake. And you think about it, you're kind of pickling yourself or you're fermenting yourself when you're taking in this extra salt. So be really, you know, really, really careful. The other thing that happens with salt, a lot of these foods also have nitrites, not nitrates, but nitrites. And so the combination of those foods can make things worse. So, you know, the risk for gastric cancers, H. pylori, elevated levels, probably a level that's protective, but again, in combination with increased salt makes it worse. Processed foods, nitrites, not nitrates, smoking a food, alcohol increases your risk of gastric cancer, being overweight, having had radiation, all come into play. There's been historical looks at gastric cancer was actually decreasing when refrigeration was discovered and people were doing less salt curing of things. But now that more of this stuff has come back into vogue, you know, we're starting to see more gastric cancer. So be really careful. There was one person looked at miso, you know, it can be from 9 to 18% difference in salt. The other thing that in Japan was high, if you looked at roe from people that eat fish and salt fish, they tend to get a high salt level. So be careful and, you know, don't make sure that you're looking at the salt content as well as, you know, the fat and the high fructose corn syrup. And then there was a study on the incredible edible egg, 29,615 adults. They looked at six prospective cohort studies over a span of 17 and a half years, and each additional 300 milligrams of cholesterol consumed each day was significantly associated with a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. So the absolute risk was increased by 3.25%. Doesn't seem like much, but if you look at a cholesterol and a statin-lowering medication, the absolute risk reduction is like 1%. So this is huge. All-cause mortality increased 4.43% absolute risk. Each additional half egg will increase cardiovascular risk 1.1%, and all-cause mortality 1.93%. So when you're looking at these kind of things, you know, an egg has 200 to 250 milligrams of cholesterol, depending on the size of the egg. Besides eating eggs and people going out and not just eating one egg, typically people eat two or three eggs, or they eat an omelet, you know, so there's eggs. But, you know, there are eggs in food, right? So the holiday season, eggs that are in pancakes and breads and cakes and, you know, hold things together like meatloaf and crab cakes and cookies. You know, a lot of times people that are new to convert to being plant-based kind of looked the other way with a blind eye to these. So there's a real high risk of getting eggs and things, even egg wash. Everything adds up. You know, and this theme of this podcast is everything kind of adds up, and there are all these toxins that, again, continue to hurt us over time. I guess the last thing I'll finish with is the game changers and what's that's meant for the plant-based community. And I think that, you know, there have been some interviews on different podcasts, people arguing and defending. There's a very popular podcast that had James Wilkes versus a self-proclaimed nutritionist. And, you know, he did a great job of defending the Game Changers movie, the data there, and also, you know, knew his nutrition stuff very good. I've always been impressed with James Wilkes' ability to know the literature, even though he doesn't proclaim to be a nutritionist or a nutrition expert, as so many people do on, you know, the internet and social media. But, you know, the funny part about it is, and these guys kept, you know, backing down. And, you know, well, I, you know, what they came to the conclusion, well, it's, you know, plants and fruits and vegetables are great, but you can have a little meat and still be healthy. But the reality of it is, and I think the best comeback for all this is, where do the animals that people eat for meat, you know, cows, pigs, chickens, fish, where do they get their amino acids? Amino acids are the building block of proteins. They come from the plants. Animals have to have plants in order to make protein. End of story. So a cow and a pig can grow very quickly, much larger than a human eating plants. The difference is they tend to take in a lot of calories. So, you know, my dad used to make you know, the comment when people that, you know, people wanted a horse to have, and, you know, if you weren't going to take care of the horse and the horse is basically just stands and eats all day, because a horse, you know, takes in thousands of calories a day through grass and oats in order to get the amino acids that it needs. So the only problem with eating fruits and vegetables and whole grains is that because there are only 4 calories per gram versus 9 calories per gram, you end up eating more if you're an athlete. So if you're a bodybuilder and you want to put on muscle, you have to eat more calories if you're working out. If you're, you know, an athlete that's burning thousands of calories, 10,000 calories a day, I think Michael Phelps burns. You know, so if you're burning 10,000 calories, you have to eat 10,000 calories. And so you end up eating a greater volume. So you have to take that into consideration. If you're going to take in a small volume, then it could be an issue. If you're going to eat a junk food vegan diet, it could be an issue. But we're not talking about that, because I don't recommend a junk food diet for anybody. So, you know, the reality of it is there should not really be an argument. We want to eat the most nutrient-dense foods that we can with the least amount of toxins. And we do that by eating the lowest on the food chain and eating unprocessed. So eating unprocessed fruits and vegetables and whole grains, beans, and legumes are going to provide all the nutrition we need without having to worry. The only supplement that you need is a B12 sublingually. And to take that 4 to 5 times a week, depending on your B12 level and your absorption, which also has to do with your ability to absorb from your stomach. And even when people have a decreased ability to absorb, you can still get enough in. You just have to take a higher dose. So you need to get your B12 levels checked so that you know the adequate amount of dose of B12 that you actually need to take in. So don't worry in the upcoming year about getting in enough protein or other nutrients, because really we're a country of disease because of too much of, not too little of. So, you know, for the New Year's coming, I'll, you know, like to say Happy New Year's to everybody. If you're ready to make your New Year's resolution and become plant-based and increase your activity and your exercise, because we know that's going to also increase your health span, we have a conference coming up March 28th, a whole day event here in Port Charlotte, bringing in speakers and a plant-based breakfast and lunch cooking demonstration. It's going to be a great day. It's going to be positive, and we'd love to have you. Go on over to the website, drdelaney.com, drdelaney.com, and you can follow the link to get your ticket. There's also information about our immersion week. If you'd like to really change your health and get started and get immersed in plant-based nutrition and exercise, we're taking a limited number of people for the week before the conference and giving them, you know, 100% of our attention. From myself and Addie, as far as nutritional education, exercise education, hands-on instruction, and great food, and how to eat out, how to make the food, how to shop for the food, and then we'll design a plan when you leave so that you can continue going forward on this healthy lifestyle to increase your health span. So we're really excited about having some people join us for that immersion week. You can find out more about that on the website. If you thought that what I talked about was good food and you'd like to get a copy of our cookbook, it's available on Amazon.com. There's also a link on the website. But I think, you know, this for the new year, choose wisely, choose every day. You know, we get to make a choice every day whether we want to be happy. You can't be happy and sad at the same time. So we get to choose that. It's not easy all the time, but we can. You also get to choose what you eat every time you sit down. And you can choose to eat fruits and vegetables and whole grain. You can keep your health in the forefront of your nutrition. So choose every day, choose wisely. Don't look back at yesterday of what went wrong or in the future of when I'll chart a change. Start today and eat a whole food plant-based diet and continue to evolve throughout the year. As for myself, you know, my New Year's resolutions or what I'd like to accomplish, I'm going to keep working on my race speed. I want to get faster, more strength, more mobility. I'm probably going to look into some intermittent fasting. I'll talk more about that in some of the upcoming podcasts. I'm incorporating more microgreens, more raw foods into my diet in the form of greens and raw vegetables, not in nuts and seeds. Some of the raw food people start going into, you know, this high fat aspect of things. I'm not into that. So be lean and green. Get your exercise. Happy New Year, and I'll speak to you in 2020.